Great. So hi, I'm Phoebe. Thank you for the introduction. So I'm an undergrad at UC Berkeley, and my group, Students United for Reproductive Justice at Berkeley, or just SURGE, has been working since 2015 to advocate for implementing medication abortion, first in our own student health center and now across the state. So I'm going to be very brief on like kind of the history and the tactics and things like that, but I'm happy to talk more about certain stuff later. Basically, in fall 2015, SURGE was founded by Diva Khan and Megan Warner, and they met with to be the explicitly pro-choice undergraduate club on campus. It didn't exist then. And around the same time, they talked to several of their friends who had tried to access abortion while being students and faced a lot of really unacceptable barriers. At the time, there was a $300 copay, which is completely impossible for most students. You have to travel off campus. We've talked to a lot of students who missed class, missed work, and just generally navigating a lot of bureaucratic hurdles. I'll talk more about what that looks across the state later, but that was kind of where this was founded from. And so our group started doing research about like, okay, what does the referral process actually look like, and why don't they just have medication abortion in the student health center? Medication abortion is really simple to provide. There was a provider who was already willing to do it, and it's extremely safe. In the case of UC Berkeley, our student health center does much more invasive procedures like IUDs already, so it's not that they don't have the capacity. So around in the beginning of 2016, we started having a multifaceted kind of public pressure campaign on the administration while also trying to meet with them privately to say, like, why aren't we doing this? What could it look like to do this? This is important to students. And we saw really a lot of student support right away. This is something students were really, really supportive of. And we also kind of got a first wave of like media attention, mostly right-wing media, you know, Breitbart being like, UC Berkeley students want to like fire all their teachers and use the money for free abortions, like stuff of that sort, which, you know, had pluses and negatives, that kind of wave of media attention. Like the negatives are probably obvious, and like we've seen the way the stigma has kind of permeated the whole campaign. But it also meant that we were harder to get rid of, because what we started seeing from the very beginning was that we'd go into meetings and we would say, you know, students are facing these barriers. This is meaning that we're not having meaningful gender equity on our campus. This is impacting low-income students and students of color in a way that should be unacceptable here. And then the administrators would say, yes, we're pro-choice. We love our women students. We don't want to do this. Please go away. And so we started, that was the first time with just the Tang Center administrators, we started to see this narrative of like, we're pro-choice. We don't want to do this at all. Let's do literally anything else. And so starting to see the way that abortion stigma, stigma that it's unsafe, that it's difficult to provide, that it's not healthcare. We saw that from the very beginning, even in spaces that were very nominally pro-choice and places that purport to be extremely liberal, like UC Berkeley, and that's kind of the reputation it has. And we thought, I think naively, that the school would be more willing to be kind of the first people to do something than they were. And so then throughout the end of 2016, we continued to meet with administrators. We found out at that point from some research and talking to them, we got them nominally on our side. It was gonna cost like $14,000 to implement, which is like, to me, I first heard that, I was like a sophomore, and I was like, that's so much money, it's never gonna happen. And then I realized like the scale of money at which like the UC system and the health center is working on, it's just nothing. Like, and so, and then they said, you know, and then these kind of hurdles they started putting up for us once they were like on our side was like, okay, we'll do it, but you have to get the money for it. And we're like, okay, applied for a grant, got the money. And they're like, okay, you need a full-time security guard, like we're gonna get all this negative publicity. And so we said, okay, got it. And then they said, we also need a full-time PR person because we're gonna get all this negative publicity. And it just kept kind of compounding, and it really escalated. Like it started with like, we need a security guard. And then it became like, we need $300,000 of security renovations that we probably just want anyways and want to price you out. And in our last meeting, I think the number they gave us for security renovations was $6 million. They were like, we need this. And we were like, we are 19 years old. And so at that point, it got kind of sent up to the higher UC Berkeley administration. And the kind of what was going on politically, nationally, and at Berkeley at the time had a pretty big impact. And so we got this same thing of, you know, we're pro-choice, we love our women students, we absolutely are not gonna do this. We don't need, is it really necessary? And then we said, well, you know, yes, it is necessary. There's no reason we shouldn't have this. And they said, okay, well, what if there's a taxi service? And we're like, no, you're not really getting that we don't need another layer of bureaucracy to go through. We just, we have this like clear set of demands. And what happened at the same time is that UC Berkeley was put in the national spotlight with Milo Yiannopoulos trying to come speak and people not allowing him to speak and like this kind of vague threat of losing federal funds. In our meetings with administrators, they cited that as like, we can't get any more bad press, we can't be in the spotlight, like we're not gonna be the people to do this. So even when we got this hard no in January of 2017, it was very explicitly for political reasons. At no point was it because it was infeasible or too difficult to implement. It was very explicitly for political reasons, which was obviously upsetting. And so 2 weeks before that, we had taken a meeting with people from the Women's Policy Institute, which is kind of a bill incubator for like feminist legislation in California. And they came to us and they said, you know, we read about what you all were doing here, about the student government resolution you passed. We would want to scale this up. Would you want to try to implement it in all the CSUs and UCs? And we said yes. And so we immediately started hitting the student organizing for that really, really hard. And that kind of came a couple weeks before we got the hard no from our administration. So there was really no like time of reflection. We just immediately started organizing for this legislation. And I do think, I'll go into the bill a little bit right now, but generally I think that our inability to get it done at UC Berkeley, given like kind of the perfect set of circumstances, like I think if we could have done it anywhere, it would have been where we were amongst like public institutions, given just like the climate in California in general and like in Berkeley in particular and what our school purports to be. And I think the fact that we couldn't and that the institution at every level was like explicitly unwilling to take on the burden of being like the first people to do it and like actively doing it speaks to the necessity of a legislative mandate. I wouldn't have initially thought that that was like the thing to do, but after my experience with our school administration, I do believe it's the only way. And so for a little context about the bill at this point, so it's gonna impact all CSUs and UCs, which is about 650,000 students. So there's a lot of people in public universities in California. And what happened once we got this legislation introduced is they pushed us to a 2-year cycle and they said, can you do some more research? So UCSF did some more research and found out that about a little over 1,000 students between both systems seek abortions at off-campus providers per month. So this is both substantial in that like this is gonna have a direct impact on a lot of people's lives. And it's also not that many when you divide it up by campus in terms of like a burden on the health center. It's not like they become like mostly an abortion clinic. It's like pretty small on the scale of what they're doing, but it has a really big impact on so many students' lives. And the other thing this study's found, besides that it was necessary and that students face really substantial burdens, which I'll talk about in a second, was that it's completely feasible. Every single student health center in California in the CSU and UC systems has the ability to provide medication abortion given some like kind of training and a couple, like an ultrasound machine and things like that. And in California, medication abortion can be provided by any licensed physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, or certified nurse midwife. So you don't necessarily need like a gynecologist or an MD to do it. And some more context about kind of the barriers and the situation in the UC system is that, so the average abortion provider is 5 to 7 miles from each of the UC campuses and CSU campuses. With a median time of 34 minutes by public transit, but that of course is a minimum. When you take public transit, you know that things take longer than like the exact amount of time. And of course, beyond that, like you have to deal with just like navigating an unfamiliar clinic, figuring out how your insurance works there, if your insurance works there, if you can get there, taking time off of school and work to go there. Most students don't have cars. I think the majority of students don't have cars. And 42% of UC students experience food insecurity, if that gives kind of a context on just the general financial situation and like what it means to have to take time off work away from class, potentially go pay for something. When we started this, again, the copay was $300. That got eliminated kind of in the process of our negotiations, which was nice to be able to have like a finite victory even when we got our rejection. So yeah, that's kind of the baseline. And so multiple visits are required also, so that means you're going twice. Five of the campuses, the travel is more than 1 hour each way by public transit. So you're saying that's at least 4 hours on public transit just to access medication abortion. So I'm almost out of time, but so Surge, my student group, is a co-sponsor of what was SB 320 and is now SB 24. I'll go into that in a second, along with Act for Women and Girls, which is out of the Central Valley of California, which is kind of the farm area. So it's a lot more rural. They face just like a particular set of barriers. And then the California Latinos for Reproductive Justice and Access Women's Health Justice, which is an abortion fund based out of Oakland. And so we, and I can go into more details about this if people want, did student organizing with students from all across the state. Ideally, you know, we're working with people on every single campus because barriers look different on every single campus. Like, I have one friend from UC Riverside who the bureaucratic hurdle she faced meant that she had to wait 3 months between the time she found out she was pregnant and decided she wanted an abortion and being able to actually get it. And that is, like, particular to whatever campus you're on and clearly is, like, so unacceptable. And so we were organizing students for 2 years. I felt our role as like the student co-sponsors and kind of the students in the room was to like center student voices in everything we were doing as the campaign kind of started dealing with more and more powerful people. And so like getting students into lobby visits, things like that. And after 2 years of this like pretty intense student organizing, again, I can go into more detail about that. We passed through the California State Legislature. We had to get through 6 committees and both houses. And then it got to the governor, and at the same time, we had like the Just Care campaign, which is broader for reproductive justice organizing on campus. And one of our main intentions is to use this bill as a way to just build a sustainable student reproductive justice movement in California and like ideally everywhere, because it's not all about like one bill or like one piece of legislation. And then in September of 2018, the California governor, Jerry Brown, vetoed SB 320, which was extremely disappointing. That man is my nemesis. But basically the justification he gave was, oh, the average distance is only 67 miles. That's fine. This isn't necessary. California's pro-choice. And so this, like, it was just the exact same argument that we'd gotten from the beginning of like, I'm pro-choice, but you're asking for too much. Like, we don't need this. You're fine. While in the face of students, like publicly and like often at personal cost, explicating on the ways at which it was necessary and like talking about their often painful stories of trying to access just their health care. And so that I think was a big kind of blow, but seeing as like how we can define victories for ourselves on it. And so we have taken hopefully a conversation that wasn't really happening before and like getting it to these higher levels. The new governor of California said he would have signed it, and so we introduced another bill that is identical. It's called SB 24, and we're still organizing students across the state for it. And so I just think our hope is that this we can have similar legislation in other states. Massachusetts introduced something similar, and our goal has always been to be able to expand and like hope that students in other states will like see their own needs and try to enact something similar. And yeah, I think in the face of really, really drastic opposition, it's important to have like push for actual progressive change and like to be really unapologetic about that, instead of just kind of like vaguely defending what we kind of already have. Yeah, and so I'm gonna stop because I went over time a little bit, but thank you.
So, even though it's been a long time, my high school speech and debate teacher said, always stand up. So I'm gonna pull back a little and look more broadly at why we're having to fight so hard on abortion and reproductive rights right now. You know, other issues that we define as cultural issues like same-sex marriage and cannabis legalization seem to be making progress at the same time we're being pushed back. And so I'm gonna argue that abortion is not a cultural issue and that we're seeing it wrong. 1 in 3 US women will have an abortion and millions more rely on it as a backup to contraceptives, which should constitute an enormous power block that if unified could overrun any opposition that we have. But abortion defenders, with a few exceptions, many of them on this panel, have been in appeasement mode. So NARAL Pro-Choice America, following the Supreme Court's reasoning in Roe versus Wade, has been for 40 years emphasizing privacy. We should be able to make personal decisions without intrusion from politicians. Planned Parenthood, which has been under massive attack, defends itself by emphasizing its role in cancer screening and well woman care. Abortion is healthcare has become a go-to slogan, and while it should be seen as healthcare, We need to be clear on the reason it's under attack, and it's not because it's healthcare, but because it gives women the power to control their reproduction. In fact, you could say abortion is women's right to strike against the unfair working conditions we face bearing and raising children. And if the current birth rate is any indication, US women are on an informal birth strike right now, which might indicate why the establishment is moving further to restrict abortion and contraception at this point in our history. So in Europe, as the birth rate has dropped, governments have come up with more support, like universal childcare, family allowances, long paid leaves for both parents. For example, in France and Sweden, over a year for parents, and that's paid leave. You don't have to go to work and you're being paid and you take care of your kid. In the US, the elite are determined not to pay for that work, especially since they have so far been able to extract it from us for free. So instead, what we've been getting is an obstacle course of increasing difficulty and expense when we try to access abortion, birth control, and even basic sex education. How do we get to this point? So the young radicals who started the women's liberation movement in 1968, and we have one here, Carol Giardina, who was involved in the first women's liberation group in the South, those radicals didn't really expect women could be free with capitalism intact. Many had already risked their livelihoods and their lives in civil rights and anti-war movements and in the New Left. And while men were sexist in those movements, that was not the only thing that made them decide to start an independent movement. After all, men were sexist outside of those movements too. Many women's liberation pioneers said that what started them on the path to an independent movement was the example of the Black Power movement. In some cases, it was the explicit instruction to whites in the civil rights movement to go fight your own oppressors, or the inspiration of uncompromising leaders such as Malcolm X. Most saw organizing for women's liberation as recruiting a new constituency to the general freedom movement while creating an independent female power base to make sure that rhetoric about equality and freedom for all actually included women. These feminists were right that women's freedom cannot be won without confronting the power of employers and the rich. And as it turned out, the movement did make important strides, but it was strides in areas that didn't cut too deeply into the prerogatives of capital and employers. In this category, we can call it column A, we have made progress on appearance and dress codes, integration of all male spaces and workplaces, men doing childcare and housework, although we still have a long way to go, better sex, and educational equality. In the areas where we're stuck or going backward, call it column B, those are the ones that require capitalists to cede control or cough up resources. So equal pay, public childcare, paid family leave, universal health care, living wage jobs that allow women economic independence from men. In fact, half of our progress towards equal pay has been a result of men's wages dropping to meet ours. Now, due to the fall in the birth rate starting in the 1970s, abortion and birth control have moved from column A, things that didn't greatly impinge on the prerogatives of capital, to column B, things that do. And our birth rate is now at 1.76, the lowest it's ever been, considerably below the replacement level at 2.1. This means that feminist advance now requires a confrontation with the power of capitalists over our reproductive work. The power structure could accommodate our demands on abortion when birth rates were already quite high, and in fact, they were panicking in the early 70s about overpopulation both abroad and in the United States. But as birth rates have dropped below replacement, they've started coming for our reproductive rights. They want our reproductive labor and they want it cheap. And so far they've been getting it cheap while we face a crisis. Even in the best conditions, raising children can be complicated, stressful, full of heartache, and at the same time, it can be delightful, rewarding, and full of love. Add money and time woes and partners who don't fully do their share. And many women are just deciding against having kids or stopping at just one, resulting in what I've been calling an informal birth strike. But making you have a child, even though it will require too large a sacrifice of every part, other part of your life, the time, energy, money, health, education, housing, professional or creative aspirations, relationships, is not an unfortunate, unintended consequence of abortion restrictions, but their primary goal. This is why there is such a fight over who will control the process. If women had complete liberty on reproduction, we'd be free to demand better conditions or refuse the labor. So is it enough to say abortion is an economic issue? Katha Pollitt writes that reproductive rights, quote, are not a distraction from the important economic issues. They are an economic issue. Without the ability to limit and time their pregnancies, women will always be disadvantaged at work and subordinate to men, unquote. Abortion allows, quote, women only to have children they want and can raise well, unquote. There's a problem with defending abortion this way. As both Red Stockings and reproductive justice advocates have pointed out, it suggests that the solution to our economic struggles is just simply not to have kids. Now, this is just one more way we're expected to accommodate ourselves to an economy that stovepipes all the good things to the top and leaves us with ashes. But this is the only solution that the Democratic wing of our political elite is willing to contemplate in response to the disaster that their policies have made of family life. Certainly the redistribution of wealth required to create a universal childcare or healthcare system is off the table. Universal healthcare will never ever come to pass, Hillary Clinton intoned in the 2016 presidential election. Her childcare proposals consisted of a blizzard of acronyms, tax credits, and special dispensations. So these are the dim horizons presented to us by the establishment. And then the Republican program looks just to be simply forced pregnancy. But I think we have immediate opportunities in the United States to move feminism towards bolder, more universal demands that would give us more independence. For example, for four decades, we've been trying to defeat the Hyde Amendment, the restrictions on federal abortion funding, as a way to expand abortion rights. With the growing demand for Medicare for all, we have a chance to win healthcare for everyone, making sure reproductive rights are fully included. That's a lot more inspiring than once again trying to get Congress to include abortion in Medicaid, which after all is a means-tested program that leaves many out. And a universal healthcare system would mean that no woman would be compelled to stay in a job or marriage for healthcare. Just as abortion is connected to questions of class power, abortion can also not be isolated from the fight against white supremacy. Loretta Ross of Sister Song attributes the sharpening abortion attacks to, quote, racist fears triggered by the decreasing percentage of white children born in the United States, unquote. She points out that this means white women in particular are the focus of intense pressure to procreate, perhaps most visibly in conservative religious communities. Quote, many of the restrictions on abortion, contraception, scientifically accurate sex education, and stem cell research are directly related to an unsubtle campaign of positive eugenics to force heterosexual white women to have babies, unquote. That's Loretta Ross. And under Trump, this motivation is becoming even more prominent, and it's adding to a racist layer, to 30 years of establishment complaints about slowing birth rates and aging populations. So restrictions on abortion and birth control are interwoven with the sex, race, and class agenda of the power structure. And if white women understand that we are a special target of white supremacist population schemes, we'll be more likely to fight alongside women of color against our common oppressors rather than seeing ourselves as privileged helpers of the oppressed with all the delusions about our own freedom that that implies. So in US polls, a consistent 20% think abortion should be illegal in all cases, with another 30% expressing moral disapproval and various levels of thinking on whether abortion should be legally permitted. But rather than giving up on half the population, I think we should study how abortion organizers changed minds in the 1960s. We did not start out as a nation of people who were for abortion. This changed very fast in a few years. And with a fresh feminist angle showing how restrictions on abortion and birth control are about keeping our reproductive labor cheap, we have a chance to reach additional women. By connecting our right to refuse reproductive labor to our demands for improved reproductive working conditions, including childcare, healthcare, paid leave, and shorter hours for starters, we can move people on this issue. Many women have only been exposed to an elitist and anti-people feminism of the 1%, whose answer to our economic struggles is that any problems you have supporting and raising your kids are your personal responsibility. After all, you had a choice. Lean in. But pro-woman feminism says women aren't dumb or brainwashed for having kids. It's important, difficult work needed by the whole society. The pro-woman line says the only thing women need to do differently is struggle collectively where we're struggling individually. If we join together, we can win better working conditions and more freedom. And the group that I'm in, National Women's Liberation, is working on both ends of this. So both the absolute control of our reproduction and the conditions where we can actually have kids. We also have a Women of Color Caucus that studies the intersections between white supremacy and male supremacy. So if you're a woman of color, I don't know where that sign-in sheet, oh, here it is. If you're a woman of color and you want to, I know some people came in late, and you're interested in getting contacted about that, please check off that box. Thanks. All right, that's all I have.
Hi guys, I'm Kate. I'm an organizer with New York City for Abortion Rights. And we are a group that formed in the aftermath of Trump's election. We sort of came together when there was these planned anti-abortion demonstrations all across the country. And we decided that the way to respond was by defending our clinics. And we believe that what we really need is to build an unapologetic grassroots movement for abortion access and reproductive justice, not just in New York, but all over the country. We're mostly known for our clinic defense, but we've also held like a lot of different educationals on abortion, including medication abortion and the Irish referendum. I'm just gonna be talking about like a few lessons that we've learned from organizing the past 2 years. So number one, while the right has been chipping away at abortion access for a very long time, since it was legalized in 1973, we've learned that this really is like a new political moment, and the right and the anti-abortion movement is extremely emboldened. With Kavanaugh joining the Supreme Court, Roe is likely to be overturned. And people have, the antis have wasted little time in bringing cases to that they hope to get taken to the Supreme Court. Just last week, Ohio passed a heartbeat bill, which effectively outlaws abortion by saying you can't have one past 6 weeks, which most women don't even know they're pregnant at that point. Pretty freshly after Trump's election, there was these groups called Red Rose Rescue, and they invaded four clinics, trying to get patients to change their mind about their abortions. In our own backyard, one of the antis at this our action called This Church Harasses Women, which we do, where we target the church, Old St. Patrick's. That they have this congregation that marches to Planned Parenthood every first Saturday of the month. And the leader of that congregation, his name is Brother Fidelis, and he's been targeting clinics since the 90s, but recently he's been arrested twice in the past few months trying to invade clinics. And just at our last action, the police brought a motorcade, and there was like maybe only 20 of us, and it was really scary, and they were threatening to arrest us like right away before we even did anything. We like band together to try to block the street and slow down their movement so that we can delay them from being outside the clinic when patients are walking inside. Okay, so number two, Democrats are not reliable allies. Like Phoebe said, was it Jerry Brown? Even when they are seemingly pro-choice, they are totally willing to give up on abortion. One example of that in New York is with the Reproductive Health Act. We had a majority of Democrats in both the House and the Senate And we could have passed whatever type of legislation we wanted, including something that's just like repeal everything. But instead of removing the gestational limits, which the person that wrote the bill asked them to do, they refused to do that, saying that it wouldn't pass because there's too many pro-life Democrats, which is happening nationally as well. So in spite of these like mounting challenges from the right, there is no response from the Democratic Party. And in fact, it's just like we give up. Number three, people aren't used to hearing the word abortion. While antis have built a movement determined to completely destroy our access to reproductive health care, liberal feminist organizations have also played into the terms that the antis have set up.
Yeah.
They've minimized abortion and attempt to depoliticize it. Planned Parenthood claims that only 3% of their services are abortion, which acts to further stigmatize it. But nationally, Planned Parenthood actually provides over 30% of all abortions in this country. And independent clinics provide 65% of all abortions, and they are extremely under-resourced and don't have the kind of donation base that Planned Parenthood does. Number four, Planned Parenthood is a great healthcare provider, but they're not a movement leader. Due to nearly 50 years lacking a feminist movement in this country, many look to Planned Parenthood to guide us in how to respond to these attacks. But this professionalized reproductive health sphere actively stunts grassroots activism by blackballing activists, delegitimizing activism as naive or misguided. You're union busting in Colorado. And this idea of non-engagement, which is something that they employ not just right outside their clinics, but that's their political strategy. And we believe that non-engagement is a losing strategy. By ignoring the antis and hoping they will go away, it has only given them free reign over our clinics. At the Planned Parenthood on Bleecker Street, we see this. Every time we're outside, the antis are guilting and shaming patients trying to go into the clinic, and no one is stopping them. We hold up signs that say like fake clinic, fake counselor, so that they're like identified, but usually they just have free reign and we can't be there every week, so. And there's like also just a really weird mix of anti-abortion activists. So there's like the crisis pregnancy center counselors, and then there's Bikers for Life, and they like have it on their leather jackets. and it is just like a crazy show outside Planned Parenthood every week. Number six, direct action and confrontation works. When we hold clinic defenses, we have successfully delayed the antis by over an hour. Our physical presence forces them to move to like this, the opposite, like the side street, so that they're away from patients and they cannot engage. And actually, at our last action, we had a patient come out of the clinic and join us, and she was super excited that there was an alternative message, because for so long we're used to just like going to the clinic and being like, this is just normal. So that was really cool. We adopt the Bay Area Coalition Against Operation Rescue's philosophy that our first line of defense for protection of reproductive rights is self-defense. We cannot rely on courts, police, or legislatures to protect our fundamental rights to control our bodies and our reproductive options. Number seven, we have sort of as a group flipped the script on by reclaiming space. And I think that it's, even though like we're a pretty small group and we've fluctuated over the last couple of years, but we actually have a lot of power in shaping the narrative by like using creative tactics. So because the antis have so normalized being outside of our clinics, we were like, well, why don't we actually just start going to their spaces, which is when we started targeting the church. And so what we do is, so we will like chant outside the church before we slowly walk to find her backwards, as slowly as we can. Sorry, hold on. Okay, being in New York kind of gives us a lot of, like, attacks are most severe in the South and the Midwest. Being in New York, we actually have a lot of power in shaping the narrative, which historically has been the case, like Jenny writes about in her second new book about abortion. but the Red Stockings were really influential in targeting, like, using their personal narratives to change, to force lawmakers to pay attention, like connecting their narratives to, like, making it political, which is a sort of, which hasn't really happened in our movement thus far. Even though we have like Shout Your Abortion, a lot of times the messaging isn't, it's not as political as the Red Stockings were. We also can have influence in New York because it's a center of journalism, and so people hear about what we're doing all over the country. I went to like the Abortion Care Network conference last month and talked to some providers that were like, oh wow, it's really cool that you're doing clinic defense in New York. And so it's getting out there, so it's pretty cool. Also, I think that being in New York, we're setting a model of how to build a grassroots movement, and that it's actually possible to do that wherever you are, and you don't have to be in New York to be an activist. And I think that that's the main message. Number nine, abortion access is central to reproductive justice. If abortion does become illegal, it's working class people who are going to pay the price. Pregnant people that have money can fly to New York, to California, to get their abortion. But in 2014, 75% of abortion patients were poor or low income. The standard price for an abortion in the first trimester is $500. Most insurances don't cover abortion. And Medicaid only covers in 13 states. Number 10, donations and calls to our senators are insufficient weapons in a war being waged against the basic right to our own bodies. The right has successfully organized against abortion by targeting it both legislatively and physically in our spaces. And we believe the only way to win this war is to bring back a grassroots movement fighting for abortion access that means like having both a legislative strategy to ensure that Medicare for All does not leave abortion behind. It means defending our clinics, and it means bringing organizing back to the local level. And recognizing that free abortion on demand is not a box to be checked once socialism is achieved, but it's central to the struggle for abortion or for socialism and a better world.
Lily, sorry for being late. I accidentally went across town. So I'm an organizer with New York City Abortion Rights with Kate and some other people here. When I was putting my thoughts together about what I wanted to say today, I'm also going to zoom out and get kind of big picture like Jenny did. I watched the trailer for Unplanned, which is now at AMC's, which is like an anti-abortion propaganda video that was timed to be released with Ohio's 6-week ban. And I was just horrified. And at the same time, I was like reading about South Korea and them overturning their abortion laws there. And I started getting really angry about the fact that we are going backwards and other struggles across the world are moving forward. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this angry, and I'm just gonna, I didn't have time to revise, so. Okay, so what's at stake in the fight for abortion? I think that what's at stake is a left-wing, one thing that's at stake, is a left-wing framing of reproductive justice. We have to build a new grassroots movement, and we have to do it on a different basis than before. I think there's a parallel to be drawn here about the Janus ruling, the right to work ruling in the labor movement. Everyone was predicting the downfalls of, you know, the public sector unions. Similarly to the way that the New York Times editorial was like, oh, to prepare for like the world after Roe, we have to like accommodate and do all of these like things to save what we have. And I think we can see how that worked out in public sector unions. We have since seen a wave of teacher strikes. So I'm going to start negative and then I'm going to get positive because I actually think there's some things we can do. Well, if I have time to get positive. Okay, so I began thinking about this issue in conjunction with other questions I have about the feminist movement in the United States or the lack thereof. The other issue that's been nagging at me and others on the left for some time is the fact that the feminist movement here doesn't have a mass movement character in the way it obviously does in other countries. And the women's strikes in Chile, Argentina, Italy, Ireland, Spain, Brazil, Germany, and even Poland. I find it striking that in almost all of these countries, abortion rights organizing has been a central thread running through these movements leading up to and during March 8th's International Women's Day. Argentina, Ireland, Poland are the most striking examples. So why not in the United States? One thing that stands out to me in this country is the unique nature of the right-wing backlash against the women's liberation movement, and most importantly, the strength of the anti-abortion movement. I think there's a link between the ability and willingness of the left wing of the feminist movement to fight for abortion and the movement's ability to develop a mass character. I don't think this is the only explanation, but I think it's part of one, and it's the thread I want to pull at. The familiar story is that women received the legal right to have an abortion in 1973. Roe set the precedent that the state could not interfere in this decision as a matter of privacy between a patient and her physician. So as many critics of Roe have noted, legal rights are not substantive rights. This did not guarantee access. And consequently, instead of simply challenging Roe in the courts, the right developed a long-term strategy to use law to diminish access until it chipped away at the foundations of Roe, and now we're actually in a position where Roe, they are in a position to reverse Roe. So at the same time, this is the side of the story that gets a little less developed. At the same time, the left was making its own critiques of the reproductive rights movement. The mainstream reproductive rights movement, which was a part of the women's liberation movement, was criticized for having a strategy that only benefited white middle-class women. I say mainstream because I think it's really important not to whitewash this history. We talk about the white, like, second wave feminist movement. There's a really excellent book called Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice, and there was not a single women of color group that was founded in the 60s and 70s that's in that book that did not support and fight for abortion rights. And they were some of the most grassroots and rooted organizations. So critics argued that the reproductive rights movement focused on the narrow idea of rights but not access, economic issues that shape the, they don't focus on economic issues that shape the environment in which people have and raise children, like Jenny was saying, and they focus on abortion but not forced sterilization. These are issues that affect women of color and disabled women in particular, not just disproportionately, but literally as a different reproductive reality than white women of more means. It's also of interest that feminism did not really arrive on the scene in the official world of labor organizing until the early 1980s. So there's a marked lack of participation in the abortion rights movement by women in organized labor of any race. In 1994, black feminists developed the idea of reproductive justice as a reproductive rights conference in Chicago. I think it was NARAL, I'm not sure, NARAL, Illinois. In 1994, abortion rights were given in the sense that no one thought Roe was under existential threat and it was time to dig in deeper. They gave body to these critiques and argued that our expectations should be higher than to have these vulnerable rights that most people who can get pregnant have trouble accessing, and if they can access them, then they do so under unequal conditions. So reproductive justice is now the dominant frame for thinking about reproductive issues for those who want to build a more inclusive and radical movement. And I think it's worth saying that when I read the way that Loretta Ross explains what reproductive justice means, I find myself thinking that if realized, it's basically a full socialist program for gender liberation in the world of health and childcare. As a socialist, I agree with this expanded idea of reproductive justice and the criticisms of, you know, liberal strategies. I think that we need to approach abortion through a reproductive justice framework. And I also think we have to be clear that the world has changed dramatically in the 25 years since 1994. Abortion is no longer a given in practice or ideologically, and there is no movement to match these raised expectations. Practically, we've seen the erosion of access lead to concrete loss of rights, or imminently so. Ideologically, A pro-life movement has co-opted feminist rhetoric to such an extent that there is now a self-conscious pro-life feminist movement that is growing. One of them actually got space with a publisher's italicized caveat in the most recent reproductive justice anthology that was published in 2017. So where does this political failure to build a radical movement for reproductive justice come from? First, the blame is on the right, and I think that's important to, you know, squarely focus on. The right has pushed us back so far ideologically that even radical millennials waver in their level of moral support for abortion compared to other issues. The right is also so militant that the bar is very high for anyone who wants to confront them and become apologetic about abortion. Second, the blame is on the left. Our movement is hardly a movement because it is trapped, this is the angry part, in the NGO nonprofit world that is less than forthcoming about its support for expanding access. We either hear that they know better than we do how to secure our rights in the courts, or we hear the cynical use of the notion that it's not just abortion, which allows NGOs to posture as being inclusive and radical. And I'm sorry to say this, but many socialists are also not willing to fight this out because they'd rather subsume abortion into more important issues like Medicare for All without a plan for how they are going to realize that goal. I got an email from someone called Michael after I wrote an article in Jacobin about Medicare for All saying, good piece in Jacobin, but one huge problem. When politicians talk about abortion, they overwhelmingly use it to manipulate female voters by distracting from their lack of commitment to serious issues, such as Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, and a living wage, which dwarf in importance to the relatively minor problems with abortion post-Roe. It's a talking point for intransigence and not an agenda for change. There is clear misogyny in treating this like it is not a serious problem, which infantilizes those of us who want to fight for it. Some on the left also leverage the reproductive justice critiques to claim that this is a white middle class issue. No reproductive justice theorist that I am aware of argues that this is a white middle class issue, as that is obviously not true for the reason that Kate mentioned. They argue that there are liberal middle class strategies that mostly benefit white women that have failed us, and I am a little confused. I think sometimes this argument is made in good faith by people who are frustrated similarly with mainstream liberal reproductive rights organizations. I also think sometimes it is made cynically by people who do not want to take this seriously. So I think there's both. The stakes are not addressing abortion head on, and this sets the stage for the right and the center to be able to divide and conquer the feminist movement as a result of the failure of the left to put forward answers about how we are going to develop a left-wing strategy for reproductive justice before the movement ever takes on a mass character. That this division ideologically appears to take place across religious or racial lines between white women and women of color is a tragedy to which the left must respond. Clear examples include pro-life feminism, which is reclaiming, you know, anti-abortion activism for the religious right, and the right-wing Black Genocide Campaign, which, if you don't know about it, it was started by white anti-abortion activists in Georgia, and it literally tries to convince Black women that it's the liberal white left feminists that are trying to persuade them to kill their own babies, and that's infantilizing in its own disgusting way. So I think I'm running out of time. Instead, I feel strongly that we need to ask how to launch a more inclusive fight for free abortion on demand that meets the needs of the diverse groups of people that need abortion care. I am super sick of people telling me it's not just abortion. We need to launch a fight that wins abortion better, stronger, and for posterity so that this does not happen to us again. And we don't have to fight for it like past movements. We can learn from their failures, and we can stop letting NGOs represent the movement from the top down. So two things, I think. Ideologically, I think we have to go through the back door to argue why abortion is central to reproductive justice, not why reproductive justice is more than just abortion. We have clearly started to lose that argument, and we need to win it back. I think important things are bodily autonomy, which means emotional health, economic health, psychological health, physical safety, and then the tie that Jenny mentioned between abortion and population control and white supremacy. Legal access to abortion, not just the right to it, means being able to set up regulations for consent to reproductive procedures as they are mainstreamed. This could include not having legal access to abortion means that abuses are more likely to occur since patients have no rights to their own bodies in place at all, which creates a breeding ground for paternalism and arbitrary state intervention. So politically, I think that to build the left, an important thing we have to do is fight for Medicare for All, which is equal and accessible. I think that's a different basis on which to win abortion access. And I think that a part of this fight has to be about regulations around sterilization procedures. There is a lot of human rights work that has been done to set basic best practices. around what these could look like. Things like only patients who can get pregnant can consent, cannot be made a condition of healthcare, cannot be sterilization cannot be performed within the auspices of a government program that does not involve informed consent, explicit informed consent rules. Patients must be informed in a language that they understand and be given a bill of rights in that language. There are a lot of things we can do, so this is the positive part, that we can actually shift the narrative now that people are open to these more universal and far-ranging class demands. But this is not automatic, and it's not automatic that if we get abortion, reproductive health care, these kinds of provisions are also going to be in it. And so I think we can launch a fight against forced sterilization in this period, and we can make some of the liberal, you know, vanguard of the NGO world sympathetic to us in that way, but I think it's going to take time.